Jesus the good teacher, Jesus the therapist, Jesus the giver of bling. The Issues Etc. book of the month for June is Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? 12 False Christs. It's written by regular guest Dr. Matt Richard. Read an excerpt at issuesetc.org or purchase Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up? By calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. The Issues Etc. book of the month, Will the Real Jesus Please Stand Up?
In the piece that I referred to that you wrote for a publication called Resurgent, you wrote, Muslim, quote, Muslims do not simply have a deficient theology. They do not know God because they have rejected Jesus Christ, his son, and they stand condemned, end of quote. Do you believe that that statement is Islamophobic?
Absolutely not, Senator. I'm a Christian. And I believe in a Christian set of principles based on my faith. That post, as I stated in the questionnaire to this committee, was to defend my alma mater, Wheaton College, a Christian school that has a statement of faith that includes the centrality of Jesus Christ for salvation.
I would simply say, Mr. Chairman, that this nominee is really not someone who is what this country is supposed to be about.
That's an exchange between Senator Bernie Sanders and President Trump's nominee for Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt. And at the end there, the senator concludes, at least strongly implies, that this nominee, because of his religious views, is not the kind of person that ought to be serving in that high office. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Thursday afternoon, June the 22nd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about the move from liberalism to secularism that may be signaled by an exchange like that. Terry Mattingly will be our guest here in the first half hour of the program. Carol Tobias joins us after that, president of National Right to Life. We'll talk about abortion and the GOP health care bill. We had some promising revelations today out of Washington, D.C. Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor, joins us to talk about the FBI briefing over the shooting at the congressional baseball practice. She's calling it both bizarre and a case of gaslighting. And then it's Christ in the Old Testament. Our series continues. We'll be in Psalm 91, My Refuge in My Fortress, with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. Feel free to join us over the next 2 hours with your questions or your comments. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet @issuesetc and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about liberalism and its move to secularism, as typified perhaps by Bernie Sanders' exchange with Russell Vogt, Terry Mattingly. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City and author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. The book also, Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here.
Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution says, among other things, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. That's actually how the article concludes. How well do you think the American people understand that very important statement in the Constitution, much less our politicians?
Well, the politicians, I think, know it's there, and I think they understand it. I don't know if the public does at all. But I want to back up for just a second and touch on a point contained in your overture. And that is the question: was Bernie Sanders demanding secularism? Because, see, this is what really gets into the interesting part of this. When you look at this from the perspective of a journalist, someone covering either religion or politics, in this showdown with Vogt, was Sanders demanding secularism out of the nominee? What do you think?
Well, if I had only his words in that hearing to go on and the exchange that he had with the man, I would say yes. With only those things to go on, he seemed to say, look, you can believe whatever you want privately, but you can't write it or say it publicly and be qualified to hold this office.
Well, but what if Vought had expressed a liberal Christian position that Muslims worship the same God and they're saved? If he expressed that, he would have been okay, right?
I suspect he would have been. I don't think that would have raised any ire in the senator.
But would that have been secular?
No.
You see my point? What really is interesting about this case is not a confrontation between religion and secularism per se. It's a showdown between people who believe that there are good forms of Christianity and bad forms of Christianity, or Judaism, or Islam, or whatever. We'll come back to Islam here in a minute. But in effect, if this man had quoted, the last couple of presiding bishops of the Episcopal Church, and said that he believed in the liberal Christian doctrine of universalism, that all are saved, he would have been fine, right? Which means that there were religious doctrines that were acceptable to Bernie Sanders, and there were religious doctrines within Christianity that are not. So not only are we dealing here with a question of whether or not we have an established religion, whether we have a religious test for someone, we actually have a question about whether or not we now have, in the eyes of Sanders and in the eyes of others, do we now have a state-mandated form of liberal religion whose doctrines are now acceptable in the state, while ancient Christian doctrines on salvation are not? And I find that to be an interesting angle on this case that I haven't seen show up in the coverage or in any of the reactions to the coverage.
So you wrote recently about a scenario in which Russell Vought was Islamic. Play that out for us.
Well, I did that because of a piece I saw online by a political activist in Washington, D.C., named Ishmael Royer, who is a convert to Islam and is a traditional Muslim. And the minute I heard the Sanders comments discussed, I immediately thought to myself, wait a minute, Christianity is not the only religion in the world that claims absolute truths about salvation linked to its doctrines. I wondered if Sanders would have challenged a traditional Muslim on exactly the same point, only with a Muslim doctrine at the center of a debate about salvation, as opposed to a Christian doctrine. Well, then I saw this piece by Ishmael Royer, who plays that out precisely, and noted that if he appeared before Sanders and was asked that question, if he had been appointed to some position in a White House administration or some other post that required a hearing at the level of the Senate, he would have answered, and I quote, "I believe Jesus was a prophet of God, but not God himself. I'd have to say that worshiping Jesus alongside God amounts to polytheism and is a rejection of the one God. There is no way I could apologize for what I believe as a Muslim. And yes, under Islam, the belief that someone worships in polytheism and does not worship the unity of God would separate them from God for eternity. Now, there are nuances in that belief, just as there are nuances in among some Christians over what happens if someone had never heard of Jesus. Or, to put it in the case of Islam, as he expressed it, what happened if you grew up and the only face of Islam you knew was ISIS? would God be just in your circumstance? So Muslims debate about these things much the same way that Christians debate about those issues. But the key is that they do believe there is an absolute truth about the nature of God and that your belief on that issue has eternal consequences. Now, what Royer, the point he made is, what does any of this have to do with working in the White House Office of Management and Budget? We are now grilling someone not on whether there is a shred of evidence of whether he has ever done anything of a discriminatory nature toward Muslims in public life. We are now denying him the possibility of serving in the U.S. government because of a theological belief, a doctrinal belief, linked to his own personal faith. That's a completely different, we're now like three notches up kind of from where we should be on these kinds of questions. It was a fascinating moment, and Royer was just amazed at what he was seeing unfold, and he was also amazed that no one on the committee or no one in the press coverage afterwards said, okay, are we now saying that it's okay to question whether traditional Muslims should serve in the U.S. government? Because that's a perfectly logical question based on Sanders' questions to Mr. Vought. Fascinating stuff all the way around.
So bottom line, in your opinion, was Senator Sanders, at least momentarily, applying a religious test?
Well, he was not only applying a religious test, he was implying the existence of kind of a state religion, which had doctrines. Let me give you a parallel case. I think you and I have discussed this before, but it comes up again. A number of years ago, Vanderbilt University, which historically was Methodist, but Vanderbilt has frankly kind of gone secular. And then all of a sudden, Vanderbilt wanted to say that religious groups on campus who accepted homosexual behavior and the advocacy of homosexual politics, shall we say, these groups were allowed to stay on the Vanderbilt campus, while Christian groups that proclaim traditional Christian standards on sexuality outside of marriage would have to leave the campus. One of the Anglican figures involved in this dispute at Vanderbilt, she made an interesting comment, which was that in her opinion, Vanderbilt had gone from being a non-sectarian school to once again being a sectarian Christian school. Only it was a sectarian liberal Christian school that was now mandating the enforcement of its liberal approaches to issues of doctrine for Christian groups that were going to be granted permission to minister on its campus. That puts a whole new spin on the thing, doesn't it? We're at something beyond secularism. We're essentially saying, we're restating a question that has come up a lot in judgments about how the press covers some of these religious issues. It seems at times that the New York Times believes that there is good Christianity and bad Christianity, and good Christianity gets to speak in the pages of the New York Times, but bad Christianity does not, or at the very least, bad Christianity does not need to be quoted accurately or have a chance to fully explain its views because those views are bigoted and hurtful, and thus the New York Times, which many people would accuse of being secular, the New York Times is not secular at all. It has a set of religious doctrines, and it's defending them. I think this puts a whole different spin on these questions, and frankly, I'm fascinated by it.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about the move from liberalism to secularism, or perhaps to, well, what is it? He said, a sanctioned state religion that looks an awful lot like liberalized Christianity. Terry is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City and author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. He's also author of the book Pop Goes Religion and founder and editor of Get Religion.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office. 314-416-8117.
I've got some friends down in Houston.
Join Mark and Molly Hemingway, Brian Wolfmiller, Rod Dreher, Jennifer Roback Morse, Scott Murray, and me for the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and Saturday, November 11th in Houston, Texas. Registration is $120. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston.
And they won't ask me questions.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Are you tired of working out at big box gyms? You'll find quality personal training and qualified instruction at Performance Fitness in Edwardsville. You can even work out for a full 30 days before making a commitment to join. Find out more at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. Performancefitness618.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about the move from liberalism to a peculiar kind of secularism. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. Terry, let's talk a little bit about the way that Senator Sanders seemed almost unfamiliar with the idea that a Christian might have an exclusive view of Jesus Christ as the only way of salvation. I wouldn't say he was shocked, but he certainly wanted to appear shocked. He seemed to be unfamiliar with this idea, kind of shocked that anyone would believe such a thing.
Well, it could be that he was just a really good actor. In the material that you played, note that the committee had already addressed the nominee about this question, which meant somewhere in the staff research preparing for this, the issue had already come up and been discussed. You might recall that the senator during his White House campaign had also spent quite a bit of time at Liberty. And I believe Sanders, unlike Hillary Rodham Clinton, during this last committee, I believe he had a religion outreach committee that she didn't, you know, because of the off-stated rumors that he was an agnostic or that his Judaism was purely cultural. And he, you know, he kind of worked his way around that in a lot of circumstances. But I find it very hard to believe that he didn't know that millions of Christians believe that salvation was through Christ alone. And thus he wanted to kind of do this seek and destroy mission. And he also knew he couldn't win. Now, this is another interesting point. If you don't have the majority on the committee, does he think at this point that making this argument in the way he did wins him Republican votes on the committee? I think you could make a case that other than that, he was striving for further favor beyond what he already has with the largest identifiable religious niche group within the modern Democratic Party, which the Pew Research Center studies a number of years ago showed to be the religiously unaffiliated, the agnostic, atheist, secularist, and liberal religious believers who would take the universalistic stance on issues of salvation. You put homosexuality or a host of other controversial issues, abortion, for example, you put all those people together, you now have the largest identifiable voting bloc inside the Democratic Party. So in effect, was Sanders actually testing the nominee, or was he trying out a new wording on these issues for his voting bloc within the Democratic Party? That, to me, becomes another wrinkle to this scene that I think is fascinating. It's also very interesting to compare this almost on exactly the same time that this was unfolding in America. Ishmael Royer noted something that I had noted as well, that you had the same issue unfolding in England, where the leader of the Liberal Democratic Party in England resigned as head of his party after repeated press questions, not so much even among politicians, but press questions questioning his evangelical beliefs. This man, Tim Farron, I hope I'm pronouncing that name right, it's F-A-R-R-O-N, Tim Farron. This is a man who had already, in terms of public life, once again, in terms of actual political actions, Tim Farron had already endorsed abortion rights and had already endorsed gay marriage. But that's not the question people were asking him. The press was pushing at him and pushing at him on a doctrinal issue, which was literally, he was asked this question three times in one famous interview, and it's been asked in almost every interview with him since in British media. He's been asking, do you think that homosexual acts are sinful? Not illegal, sinful. And eventually, he was driven out of power in the Liberal Democratic Party because of his refusal to give a clear enough answer on what was essentially a doctrinal question. Once again, he had already endorsed gay rights. He had already endorsed gay marriage. They're wanting to know if his private, personal, religious beliefs on a doctrinal issue should exclude him from public service. You see, that's pretty much the same question as the Sanders drama?
One thing I wish could have been done, because the Sanders exchange simply ended with the senator saying, well, Mr. Chairman, I don't believe this is the kind of person that we want, you know, serving in this position. Just a simple, Senator Sanders, why? Please explain your reasoning. Why, based upon what you've just talked about with the nominee, he shouldn't be working in the Office of Management and Budget?
Well, I think the question you're actually asking, I don't think the senators grill each other in this kind of hearing, but why didn't one of the Republicans respond by asking the nominee, do you view this as a violation of the Constitution and a religious test of whether or not you get to serve in office? Wouldn't it have been in the political interest for one of the Republicans to have raised that question? I certainly would have thought so. Ishmael Royer made an interesting point, and I talked to him, as you always when you're interviewing someone for a column, you ask all kinds of things that never make it into the 700 words, or I sometimes jokingly say the 666 words of my typical column. I write to a very tight format that's plus or minus 5 words every week. It has to be a very precise length to fit into newspapers that lay out, you know, the features such as mine in advance. Royer made an interesting question. He thought that America right now is being torn between a traditional British tolerance on issues of religion and something some public doctrine that's more like the hostility to religious doctrine at all that we see in France, or that has been seen in France in the past. And instead of calling Sanders and others who are taking this kind of a stand, he says, you really can't call these people liberals, because what they're arguing is not liberal in the sense that America has traditionally understood the First Amendment, religious liberty, free speech, and liberalism. I think you and I have discussed this before. I frequently ask, you know, what should journalists call someone who is weak on free speech, weak on freedom of association, and weak in defense of religious liberty? I don't know what the label is there, but I'm not sure you can call that person a liberal under the political thought that has been traditionally used here in America. Well, Royer went way beyond where I was at the moment, and he said perhaps the word for these people is Jacobins. Now, if you know any history about the French Revolution, the Jacobins were quite literally, the bleeding edge of the French guillotine when it came to religion. These are the people who massacred nuns, priests, and everything in their violence against public expressions of religion. A kind of lingering hint of Jacobinism is why in France we've seen these recent disputes about whether Muslim women can wear hijabs or burkinis at the beach, where I think you and I have laughed about it before. It's okay to wear a wetsuit that completely covers you. But if you wear that wetsuit in the name of Islam, you'll be run off the beach. Well, this French kind of hostility to public expressions of religion, I mean, no crosses around necks on airplanes, no skull caps under certain types of situations for Jews, no traditional Muslim garb in public schools, which has left a lot of Muslims having to go to Catholic schools to be in a place where they can live out their faith. I thought that was a very provocative way of framing this, that right now America, some people in America, can't figure out if they want to continue along this British tolerance of religious differences, where people say, I don't believe what you believe, but I would die to protect your ability to believe it. And this more French spirit, which also for a period of time infected Turkey and Turkey's approach to Islam under the Young Turks. This is really interesting stuff, and I'm amazed we haven't seen any press coverage that really jumped on this, because this is religion, but this is also a very important political issue in this day and age, and I'm waiting for coverage.
Two final questions. Isn't part of the problem that if we have decided we want to take the French Revolution approach, there's no real limiting principle there that would keep one form of speech protected as opposed to another? There's no backbone to that kind of approach in terms of freedom of speech, belief, or conscience.
Well, like I said, the backbone is truly radical. I called it the bleeding edge of the guillotine. And it pretty much comes down to whether or not you want to give the state the power to stamp out certain forms of religion. Now, nobody that I know of has proposed that. We are talking in this case, though, about whether certain privately held, let alone views that are acted upon, are certain privately held beliefs enough to get you kicked out of a political party? Are they enough to get you denied a chance at certain public offices in America? Now, at some point, surely the right is not going to try to apply this to religious liberalism. I can't imagine that. But I'm curious to know when some people note that we've created in our public media and now in some forms of public life, we seem to be enforcing this idea that there is good Christianity and bad Christianity. We already know that there's good Islam and bad Islam. There's moderate Islam and fundamentalist Islam. The issues there are somewhat different. You can be a perfectly doctrinaire believing Muslim and not believe what ISIS believes, you know, about caliphates or anything else. But isn't this fascinating that doctrine would become such a crucial issue in politics? I, as you can probably tell, I'm thoroughly intrigued with this. And at some point, someone in the press is going to have to notice.
Finally then, Terry, I had a listener question about this shortly after Senator Sanders had his exchange with Russell Vogt. And they were saying, well, he's advocating for some sort of rejection of Christianity. And my response was, well, Senator Sanders isn't against religion. He's against absolutes. But after listening to you for the last half hour, I want to modify it and see what you think. He's not against religion. He's just against, he believes in a test, a religious test for some religion.
Well, but I think the absolutes issue is crucial because most of the doctrines that he finds offensive are when you state the following religious doctrine is absolutely true. Now, I know out there right now, there's a listener saying, oh, that means that the only absolute truth is that there's no absolute truths. Right. We can wander into that maze. But it's key to me that there are certain religious doctrines that continue to collide with issues in American political life. And I think Sanders would say he doesn't want absolute truths on those issues except for his? That's the question.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. And he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much for being our guest.
Very glad to be here.
Carol Tobias will be with us on the other side of the break. She is president of National Right to Life. We're going to talk about the GOP health care bill that was, at least on the Senate side, unveiled earlier today, and what bearing it may have on abortion. Stay tuned.
Memoria Press invites all Issues Etc. listeners to explore our Simply Classical curriculum, a set of full-year academic curriculum packages for children with learning challenges. Our classical writing program and our Christian studies are now based on your favorite CPH Bible storybooks. To learn more, visit classicalspecialneeds.com and use promo code LPR to save on your initial purchase. That's classicalspecialneeds.com.
Mount Zion Lutheran Church in Greenfield, Wisconsin, is a congregation of those gathered by the Spirit of the Lord around His saving word and sacraments. At the center of our life together is the divine service of the risen Jesus, the Lamb of God who was slain, who takes away the sin of the world. If you are in the Milwaukee area, we invite you to share with us in our Lord's gifts of forgiveness and new life. Services are on Saturdays at 5 p.m. and Sundays at 9 a.m. For more information, visit our website at MountZionGreenfield.org.
If you've ever attended an Issues Etc. conference or any number of events that take place across the Senate and have wondered why more people from my congregation aren't here, check out the special seminar package the CLCC is offering for the 500th anniversary. All you need so the pastors of your circuit can organize, promote, and present a seminar that appeals to the members of your congregation, even the youth, is provided free by the CLCC. Just go to the CLCC.org and click on the blue box, or check us out on Facebook.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. Issuesetc.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Quality,
quantity qualified. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.